Hi everyone, welcome to the Absolute Jiu-Jitsu Debate. We discuss using ideas from sports science and other performance sports to improve how we train and develop in Jiu-Jitsu. All of this was originally released on video. We often put graphics and diagrams over the talking heads. So if you want the full experience, check us out by searching Absolute MMA St Kilda Melbourne on YouTube. Otherwise, enjoy the show.
Here again with Tom Crick. Continuing our discussion, if you haven't seen the previous part of this. So Tom is the head of track and field athletics at Aspire Academy in Qatar, and he's a BJJ brown belt. He was previously director of coaching and athlete development in Northern Ireland and worked for British Athletics in the run-up to the London 2012 Olympics. As I said, I met Tom on a training camp. He had some really good insight into how elite athletes are training and preparing and like essentially planning out their training. So Tom's going to go through what we're going to discuss today.
Cheers, Lockie. I think one of the things that's worthwhile mentioning that I didn't talk about much last time is the fact that although I work in track and field, my development as a coach has been heavily influenced by people from other sports and related disciplines. And a key reason for this is that the people behind the high performance system in the UK actively encouraged cross-pollination both between sports but other related high-performance fields. But it wasn't just that, it was also the fact that on a daily basis I was working with people often in sports science, maybe physiologists, strength and conditioning coaches, nutrition, psychologists, etc. And these people have previously worked in other sports systems, and therefore they were bringing their experiences to what I was doing. And they were saying, hey, in my previous team or in this area, we used to do this stuff. How about we think about bringing that to track and field? And of course, the idea of this series is to do exactly the same thing for jiu-jitsu. So the idea of today's discussion is to talk about planning, because that's something, you know, you never really hear talked about in jiu-jitsu very much. And today we're going to focus on your preparation for ADCC and compare it to how people might prepare for other sporting competitions. But in the future, what we might do is do this again, but then talk about how to apply the same kind of concepts to planning a curriculum or whatever it is for your academy.
I imagine the process that you go through to prepare for something like ADCC will be in some ways quite similar to how your average person who just wants to get better should approach their training as well. Obviously, there's probably some things about like peaking your performance at the right time, but also just like in terms of how to structure your training to get the most out of your learning is another factor, I think, which we will discuss that will be really useful for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I think it's good to start with ADCC because ADCC, you know, was pretty special for you specifically, but also it wasn't the first time that you'd been there, right? So what I'm really interested to start with is to start to explore how you initially went in 2015, then you went in 2017, and how those experiences in 2015 and 2017 shaped how you prepared for 2019. So maybe could you describe your experience at 2015 and 2017 and what you took away from those?
Yeah. So 2015 was obviously the first ADCC I'd been to. And I think there'd probably be a lot of people in Australia who are grappling who would potentially have a goal of getting to ADCC. And I think that was kind of where I was at then. You know, I was like, wow, if I can get to ADCC and compete in ADCC, I can tick my career off in jiu-jitsu. I've done well. So once you're there, it's a big leap to go from getting to ADCC, you know, to be able to, you know, qualify to then, I guess, feeling like you've got a really good shot at winning it. And of course, you're going to try that. So in that first one, I was preparing for Gilbert Burns. Funnily, my strategy was probably not too different to how it is now, to some degree, in that I thought the biggest gap in the knowledge would be in the leg locks. So I fought Gilbert Burns, and my plan was to try to get to the legs. But to be honest, like, you know, if you had asked me to give an honest account of what I thought my chances were, it would probably be very, very low of winning that match. But you know, I felt like I did reasonably well. I think in that match, I managed to, Durinho, he passed my guard, in the regulation time. And then I managed to recover and we're playing from guard until about 30 seconds to go. And I think I tried to go for a leg lock that wasn't there because I didn't back my wrestling at all against him. So I thought, if I don't get to his legs, I'm going to lose. So I went for the leg, and I think he took my back and then armbarred me with about 10 seconds to go. He got that armbar. So it was clear who the better grappler was there. But at least that kind of, you know, having seen the level, I still felt like I did, like, you know, I was like, okay, like in 2 years I could maybe make up quite a lot of ground there. And that led us to 2017, where again, being an Australian, if you win the Asia Oceania trials, and the unfortunate thing is it's probably they tend to look at that as one of the easier trials to win. So they'll give you one of the most tough invites. Usually someone who's placed top three is who you'll fight. So then I faced JT Torres, who's obviously he won that year. I faced him first round, and I put on a pretty good performance. It was a better performance than probably I would have, if you had asked me what the likely outcome of that match would be. I probably did better than I'd fought. I could actually fought JT before in the gi, but this was obviously no gi, and an ADCC rule set. So that one I lost by 2 points in overtime due to a takedown. So I came away from that thinking, okay, like I didn't get my guard passed in the whole 15 minutes of a match. You know, JT was probably pressuring the situations a lot more than me, but I did think that I'd made a considerable amount of ground from the previous one, and I lost in a wrestling scramble, essentially, that I thought, okay, if my wrestling was good enough, like theoretically from that match, if I had better wrestling than him, I could have possibly won. So that was a kind of big, it's quite inspiring for me for the preparation for the next ADCC to say, okay, like I'd already been working my wrestling. I knew that was like an incredibly important aspect of that rule set. So, but then in the 2 years leading up to this ADCC, there was a huge focus on wrestling and of course continuing with the leg locks.
And so a lot of that motivation came from the fact that you lost on those 2 points. Was that something that really cemented it in your mind as this is something I absolutely must do, be better at?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think having that result, just having a, you know, 2 points is, especially from a takedown in a 15 minute match, it can, you know, in a wrestling scramble, that seems like something you could train for 2 years and make up. That difference seems achievable. So that probably did focus, like, you know, really increase my focus. And I guess if you went in there and you lost within 30 seconds, it's possible you could kind of go, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to make it, which has definitely happened to me in matches before. But, you know, I've seen, you know, from now 17, nearly 18 years of training and competing jiu-jitsu, I've seen how you progress. So, you know, like there've been matches that I've, you know, done poorly in, but overall you just see constant progress. And I kind of knew that would happen, but, so I think I had a good mindset for learning, but yeah, seeing the particular areas I could work on was a really big factor, I think.
And we talked about this last time about the importance of having clear goals, etc. Do you feel that as you went through from 2015, 2017, 2019, your goals became clear about what it is you actually need to do to win?
I would say the strategy hasn't changed. Like the strategy I would have planned on, it went from, like, you know, in 2015, my wrestling, I would say, was not up to scratch. 2017, I'd been working my wrestling a lot, whether it was at a level to be, you know, beating the best guys in ADCC, obviously not, but like it's something I had been focusing. I knew that was something I had to focus on, and leg locks as well. Just, you know, looking for the areas that I thought had the biggest gaps in knowledge from the current competitors. So I worked, yeah. And then, you know, pretty much the same strategy from 2017 to 2019, but the focus in my training was a lot better. I think it was a lot smarter and really directed, which was really, I think, from speaking to you, because probably prior to that, it was, I would train, you know, I knew I was working my wrestling and my leg locks, but it wasn't, you know, very well, like, directed, like, okay, this is what you're working for the next year, like, you know, or and so on, like on this particular area. And I think we'll get into it, but there's a little bit on body lock passing as well in there too. But yeah, so it was certainly more focused.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what I saw. I thought, you know, from speaking to you, it was interesting that straight away you were talking about the fact that you were going to be, you know, working on wrestling. And then the fact that you took the idea on board is kind of interesting, because every time I meet someone different sport, I talk about some strategies and stuff, and very few people actually listen and change their behavior as a result of it. And it was true in the British sporting system as well. When they first started this concept, people didn't do that. And I've seen in track and field, people could articulate what it takes to win, and then you look at their training and not actually doing it. They're not actually focusing on where they need to focus. And it's an easy mistake to make, because often we train what we like to do, or the area that we need to improve on is something we hate doing.
That's wrestling. I mean, I think I've mentioned this before, but wrestling is probably the least fun. Like if you said to me, like, you're not competing anymore, you're just doing jiu-jitsu for fun, I probably wouldn't train wrestling as much as I enjoy it when I'm training it. Like it's similar to jiu-jitsu in like the problem solving aspect, but the physicality and the potential for injury and so on is much higher, and it just makes you tired. So I think there's a big problem in grappling where a lot of the time, whatever you want to focus on is kind of what you feel like at the time. And rarely in the middle of rolling, you know, when you're a little bit tired, do you go, yeah, I want to do wrestling rounds and be absolutely exhausted. That's not the most common thing for people to willingly go to. But I think if they've actually planned it out and said, okay, this is what I have to work on for, you know, and I've got this much time to do it, then hopefully that's a big motivator for actually doing that. And I think probably the next level would be actually, you know, writing down and scheduling out your session so that you have to do it. That's what you do on that day.
Yeah, absolutely. And ADCC is not the only big kind of competitive grappling tournament you're involved in. You're also involved in EBI, which had quite a different rule set. How was the preparation for EBI different to what you did for ADCC?
Oh yeah. it was my least favorite training was preparing for EBI. It's a funny one, cause it's a really good, rule set to watch. It's very exciting to watch, and you get a clear winner. As a person training for it though, I just find it really tough. If you want to win, you have to expect that unless you're just way better than your opponents and you're going to submit them all in regulation, then you've got to expect that it's probably going to overtime. And I think, you know, even the best guys, occasionally you'd see someone submit everyone in regulation, but most of the time someone would at least get to one overtime. So you've got to be prepared for that. And you probably should really be doing most of your training on the overtime positions. I mean, that's working your finishes anyway. So if you're going to spend time working your finishes, you might as well work on your arm bars or your finishes from the back. And at the same time, it's worth investing in submission defense, getting out of the back and armbar. So, you know, for me, it was probably 50-60% of my training was specific training from those positions. And it's tough, like having, you know, one person or rotating through different people who are trying to armbar you and you're, you know, holding your arm. That probably gave me some strong biceps, but that was tough. Tough on the body. So I didn't find that very sustainable.
And did you have like a specific strategy there? Like from doing those overtime rounds, did you decide whether the back or the arm bar was the best, what thing you were going to go for, and how did that work out?
Yeah, I was doing back and the arm bar. And for me, I found I was getting more arm bar finishes in training. So I'd made the decision that once I'd made that decision, I really tried to just focus more on finishing the arm bar than the back, which obviously I didn't finish one in overtime, but I got an armbar in regulation against Hani Yaya. And I think that actually came down like the feel. It was actually a very good form of training. Just, you know, working my arm bars over and over, and getting a feel for like how, when someone's starting to escape, how you can recorrect and, you know, reclaim the control that you've lost and work to the finish. So it translates to more than just the overtime. I got the armbar in regulation, but you start seeing armbars from other positions and finding them easier as well. So that was it was a really good process to do that. I just didn't find it particularly enjoyable.
Yeah, and do you think that really like cemented in your mind the fact that specific training from certain positions can be a really useful tool?
Oh, I was doing that well before then, though. Yeah, some specific training I've been doing probably the last 10 years. I think for a long time, I've thought that's the most important aspect of training. And it was usually, most of my training is comes off troubleshooting. Like I roll someone, especially when I've got someone who I find very frustrating, rolling Craig or Kip Dale or these people who you're losing most of the time to, and you're trying your move and you're seeing over and over again that your move's getting blocked. That really makes me, want to hone in on that particular area that my move's getting blocked and figure out and specific train and drill and problem solve like that. So I always thought kind of using rolling to identify your, like to kind of troubleshoot, find your areas and area you need to work on, and then specific training that. It's been something I've done for a while, but yeah, doing more of that. I probably hadn't done, but prior to EBI, most of my competitions were IBJJF, where, to be honest, the differentiation between winning and losing was more so based on whether you could pass guard and sweep. So to get into a end stage finishing position and spend most of my time doing that was probably new to me. That's something I've done a lot more since. I've kind of seen the value in training the finishes in a high level of detail.
It makes sense to me, but I think kind of the key thing that I guess we take away from that is the fact that preparing for ADCC and EBI are completely different things, right? And so I imagine training as a result of that, from what you explained, look completely different. And so when we're moving forward this discussion, we're going to be talking specifically about ADCC. And I think when people see what you were doing, they'll see that there was a very heavy emphasis on the rule set and the concepts behind that. And that led into the way that you planned and you prepared, which again, coming back to our goal session we talked about in the first series of videos, like I think that's a really key take-home message. So what I want to do now is I want to go and really look at what you're planning. And when you plan, one of the first rules of planning is you plan backwards, okay? You start off by looking at the big picture, maybe a year or even 4 years. Then you go down to week by week. Then you go down to day by day. And that's what we're going to do. And if you look at the original kind of information on planning, a lot of it came from the Soviet bloc. A lot of it came from Russia, from GDR in East Germany. And so they often use some terminology that's quite different. So maybe if you're not used to using this terminology, you'll find it difficult. So what I want to start with is just talk a little bit about some of the terminology. And from a sports perspective, usually what you're looking at is you're looking at a time frame over which your sport is happening. So in ADCC, it happens every 2 years. In the Olympics, sports happens the Olympics is every 4 years. So we plan in 4 year cycles. You're probably planning in 2 year cycles. From that, you come down and you look at your year, because humans work in years, and you break that year down into periods, what we call periods. Then from that, you use something called a macro cycle, and below that, a mesocycle, and then a microcycle. And that terminology could be confusing if you haven't seen it before. If you go and look on the internet, you'll also see these, sometimes you'll see these things described slightly differently, but this is the stuff we're going to use for this discussion. But I'll come back and I'll put it into kind of simple terms as we go through. So first of all, looking at year to year and month to month, the first thing that you probably do when you sit down and you plan is you sit there and you look and you list the competitions, the big competitions that were happening. So in 2018, you just finished the end of 2018 with the Nogi Worlds in California. And after that, what were the next big competitions that were going to be coming up in 2019 for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important one would have been the ADCC trials. Obviously I needed to win that to actually get to ADCC. So that, you could almost say that was my goal. I mean, my end goal was ADCC. It's a weird one when you're planning to try to, you're trying to, I wanted to get to the level where I could medal or maybe win in ADCC, but I don't even know if I'm going there yet, which is a tough one. So there's ADCC in September and the trials were in, I think, May or something. Actually, the trials were meant to be around the time of that Nogi Worlds, but that was in Kazakhstan, but they got cancelled a week before we went there, which they got cancelled because there was not enough entrance, which is actually a blessing because I was, maybe not a blessing because it would have been good to have another shot at it, but I'd actually had an injury a rib injury that whole month. I hadn't rolled the whole month, and I'd flown to Kazakhstan ready to compete and just risk that injury getting worse or in the chance of winning it. So, but then I ended up fighting on Polaris anyway, that same weekend. So, yeah.
So I guess the focus was the ADCC trials. And like, I think what you're describing is seen in a lot of other sports. So in most sports, let's just say track and field, you have to qualify by achieving a standard or, you know, go for a series of competitions and win those before you qualify. And in some sports and some countries, especially Olympics, can be brutal. So for example, at the Olympics, if you're competing for America in track and field, you have to come top four or top two at the US trials. And it doesn't matter where you're ranked in the world. It doesn't matter if you're the number one world record holder, whatever. If you don't win those American trials in track and field, you don't go. So since America is very strong in track and field, for them, the American trials are actually often harder than the Olympics because everyone's fighting to get there. And if you're not top two, it doesn't matter if you're injured, whatever, the selectors won't select you. So I think that pressure that you felt was, you know, is real. And it's something that I think will be different maybe for 2021. If you go to ADCC, then maybe you'll get an invite and then your preparation will be different.
I'm expecting an invite. So if I don't get invited, then I guess I'm not competing because I'm not going to do I think because you're medaled, I think you don't have to do the trials. But they usually don't announce the invites until after the trials. But yeah, I'm pretty sure I got a medal. So I'm pretty sure that's a default.
No, I think from a marketing perspective, they've got to have you back, haven't they? I mean,
yeah.
It's a great story. It's a great story. So hopefully, but that will then change your preparation. But, you know, you did the ADCC trials. And then, of course, the Worlds were then later on, right? Later in the year in California in September, I believe, 28th, the 29th of September. And then through the rest of the year as well, I guess you had some smaller competitions as well. Did you pick those competitions ahead of time or did you just like take the smaller competitions when they came?
To be honest, I took them as they came. There was you're talking before the trials or?
Yeah, or after, you know, you had several competitions throughout the year. So for example, Grapple Fest, you had two of them, first versus Bradley Hill and then Ross Nichols. And then you did the team competition. Like, how did you choose those? Was there a specific reason you chose them or was it just, it was an opportunity and you thought, oh, that makes sense at this period in time for me to do that?
It's probably just because that was, you know, I was asked as an opportunity to compete for most of those. The Kinetic one, I definitely thought would be good to, you know, it was about a month before ADCC. I think it would be good to just, you know, because when you haven't competed for, you know, a few months, sometimes the feel for competition is different. So just getting one competition in before then was important. I also did a few wrestling competitions, which they were probably more planned. You know, I thought my, obviously I had the leg locks, which I definitely wanted to be a big factor, but I thought any of the difficult matches in ADCC were probably going to come down to a wrestling scramble as being the most important thing. So I did some wrestling competitions. And to me, that was the ones I definitely had to do because if you can take someone down who's a wrestler, you're going to be a lot more confident going against a jiu-jitsu person. Whereas if you go in a jiu-jitsu comp and take someone down, you might not be so confident in then scaling that up to an ADCC competitor. So that's why I was probably more focused on those. I don't think that you probably won't find them on my, you know, BJ Heroes page or anything on the dates of them, but they were in there. There's a few of them. Probably not too many, but yeah.
Because I saw the Australian Wrestling Championships. I think you won that in 2019, right? Which was, I looked at the results and actually there was quite a lot of people, like 12 people or something in your category. So it wasn't a small competition. But what were the other ones that you did? Was there other like small provisional or provincial ones?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of it. There was definitely another one in there. But yeah, the National Championships, there was quite a few people in the division, but it was a non-Olympic weight division. So this was part of the Olympic qualification and the 79 kilo division, which is kind of what I was roughly walking around at, was what I wanted to compete in. And because I didn't want to cut down to 74 and I also didn't want to fight someone 85 kilos, you know, in wrestling where I could potentially get injured. So, but those were the more stacked with the high level competitors, those divisions. So even though it was the nationals, it probably didn't have the ones who were really gunning for Olympic qualification in there.
Yeah, okay, that's good to know, because you know, like obviously winning for any national competition is difficult, but obviously if people were cutting 74, 85 or whatever it was, then that would, you know, that would also explain that the, you know, the level of competition. But also, as you said, like I think a key thing there is that, you know, you identified that this was potentially somewhere you could get injured, and therefore, you know, you have to make decisions based on that as well, which I think is key, because most wrestlers would have gone, where am I going to win? Whereas you were thinking, where am I going to get the best outcome for my training, which is ADCC?
Yeah.
So if we look at those competitions throughout the year, you can see that with the trials and then the actual ADCC itself, that kind of divides up nicely into two parts. And then you also had that original Grapple Fest competition. So you could theoretically break your year up into three segments, at least what we would call periods. So you could have the first period before the Grapple Fest, then you could have the next one before the ADCC trials, and then the final one would be before ADCC itself. So that's the big picture in terms of periods. If we break it down now and we go into what we call macro cycles, did you break down that preparation period, you know, the period between Grapple Fest and ADCC trials into different segments? There was the areas where you worked on something different, or was it all the same?
Yeah, so I kind of break it down into the competition preparation and a skill development phase. Where if, you know, I suppose, like you said, if you work backwards from the competition, you know, I feel like you want a good eight weeks of higher intensity training, getting used to yourself moving at a higher pace, with more intensity, and really trying to win every, you know, like you're playing your strategy, so that by the time the competition arrives, I feel like the strategy that I'm using, I'm very comfortable in exactly what I need to do, and I have a good feel for the pace. So there's that side of it, and then I would have like a skill development phase, which is really a slower pace and focused more on troubleshooting the areas. Like obviously, it was focused on wrestling and leg locks and trying to develop them. But it's not necessarily about winning every round. It's about improving. It's a slower pace. I don't mind if it's a, if I'm not getting like the really hard rolls, although I still, you know, you don't want to be unfit and then do 8 weeks of of harder training. So there'd still be hard rolls in there occasionally, but not like not a deliberate amount. And it'd be more about volume, you know, getting more training, more volume of training in, whereas the competition phase, I'll cut down the volume a lot, but have a higher intensity.
Yeah. So if we just look at this now, I've like tried to line this up so that we can see what's happening here. Put it into some into perspective, and here you can see you had the first period that I could call the period in preparation for Grapple Fest 4. Then you had period 2 where you were ADCC trials, and then the final period, which was the preparation for Worlds. And then each of those different segments you could then break down into two key parts: the skill development phase and what you called competition preparation, where you basically, you know, talked about it being 8 weeks out.
Would you say that's a similar thing to how other sports are practiced, like or planned out?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're basically describing there is pretty much identical to what most people do. And I'll talk you through the classic, you know, the classic textbook periodization style strategy. And this is one that I created for the coach development program or coach education program in the United Kingdom, where basically you can see here, we're breaking up the season similarly. We have national indoor championships, which might be your no-gi worlds, right? And then you have your outdoor championships, which might be your gi worlds, for example. And then you have the Olympic Games. And then you can break that down into three periods. So you have the period one up to the national indoors, then the national outdoors. You have a second period. Then you have, once you've qualified at national outdoors, then you might have this shorter period where you prepare for the Olympic Games. And if you then take one of those periods, so let's say we take period one, you can then break that down into what we call macro cycles, which is exactly what you described. And so the traditional macro cycles that you have are something called a transition phase, something called a preparation phase, and something called a competition phase. The basic concept behind the transition phase is you've just finished doing whatever your last competition was, and therefore you need a period of passive rest probably to recover. In the case of combat sports, this would be very important. Imagine that you had a slight injury or something in a competition, let's say you're doing MMA. After an MMA fight, there has to be a period where you stop, where you basically let your body heal from the fight. Then you'd probably have a period of active rest within that, where you'd then be doing some activity, but you wouldn't necessarily be back in full training because maybe, you know, you've hurt your hand or something, you've got a strain in your wrist, you can't do everything you want to do. But then there'll become a period where, okay, you've made that transition from where you were doing that major competition and you go into a preparation phase, which is exactly what you described, that skill development phase. And traditionally, they break that up into two parts, general preparation and specific preparation. With the idea behind general preparation is that, look, you just had some time off, so you need to get your body back ready to train. And then you have your specific preparation where you've got your key goals you're trying to work on, the things that, what does it take to win things, the things that you think are going to close the gap between you and your competition, and you're going to work through those. Once you finish that point, you should then be ready, close to ready to start to compete. And then you go into what typically people call a competition phase. And it depends, like, you know, obviously your sport, how you do that. But usually you kind of choose a few competitions that you might do. You get really into the idea of training for that competition. You practice your rules, your tactics. You know, you make sure you're sharp. You would do exactly what you said, which is you'd stop trying to learn new things and you'd try and perfect what you already have. Because, you know, you don't want to go into a competition trying stuff out that you've never actually practiced in training. So the idea is to do that what we call pre-competition, and then go into the competition phase. So that's traditionally how they lay it out from an Olympic perspective.
I think this is a good place to recap on what we've discussed so far. Starting off with when you plan, you work backwards, starting with the big picture before zooming in to focus on the details. And you normally start off with the biggest time frame, which is usually determined by the frequency of your most important competitions. In this case, we're talking about ADCC, so the cycles for Lockie will be 2 years long. From there, we then zoom in to look at a year, and within that year, we normally tend to break it down into periods, with a period being the time between most of the major competitions. So in this case, ADCC trials, and then the ADCC World Championships themselves. Within this period, we then break that down into macro cycles, and actually Lockie identified two of those, one which was focused on skill development, and the other focused on competition preparation. And the reason for actually breaking these things down is to create clear goals for each phase of training, so that you know what it is that you're trying to achieve and how hopefully when these are put together, they will achieve the outcome that you most desire, in this case, winning a medal at ADCC. So the basic strategy is one that's commonly used in other areas where you take a big problem that you're trying to solve and you break it down to a number of smaller steps to make it easier to manage. When we looked at the biggest time frame, we talked about how each two-year ADCC cycle from 2015 to 2017, then 2017 to 2019, taught Lockie something else. It both helped him understand what it is that he needs to focus on in order to win, but also between those cycles, he became more systematic at sticking to his plan. We then talked about the role of the smaller competitions, how they can be used to battle test your improvements and check on your progress. For example, Lockie talked about the fact that he did a number of smaller wrestling competitions to check his progress in that area before he moved on to compete at ADCC. Finally, towards the end, we discussed how in classic planning theory, macrocycles can then be broken down to something called mesocycles, with each mesocycle having a specific goal that's clearly defined in relation to where the athlete finds himself at that point in the season, but also in relation to the challenges that will face in the next part. It is at this mesocycle level that things move from being somewhat abstract and theoretical to becoming far more practical. So hopefully you've enjoyed the discussion and we'll tune in next time when we will break down each of the skill development and competition preparation macrocycles into smaller mesocycles and then discuss the goals of each of these smaller timeframes. As always, let us know your thoughts in the comments below and remember to subscribe to the channel and hit the bell so you can get notifications whenever Lockie releases new content. Thanks for watching and I hope to see you in the next video. So that's it for this episode. If you like the podcast but want to see the diagrams, you can get the full experience by searching Absolute MMA St Kilda Melbourne on YouTube. See you in the next episode.